Fortunately, I think I caught a cold. I'm not feeling too well today. I hope my voice keeps up. And we may also keep this first session a bit shorter than usual and maybe a bit more practical than me giving a theoretical introduction. That should change. As usual, we have to start with a bit of a theoretical stuff about the course itself. So this is the course wiki. You all should have gotten the URL for the course wiki. And if you create an account on GitHub and send me your username, then I can give you write access to the wiki. And the first thing that one of you could do for me is fix that broken image here. That should actually be a cool Julia logo with the colorful dots, but I somehow couldn't manage it work. And since this course is not about me teaching something to you while you sit back and twiddle your thumbs, but you all want to learn something, you want to do something, you may as well participate in contributing to the wiki. So when and where? We'll be here in the Bob room, except the next three or four times. Bob room was booked, probably be in the Alice room, just one room downstairs. And then October 29, there's no room available. There's the Scientific Advisory Board Committee meeting, and they apparently booked up all the meeting rooms on that Thursday. Right, thank you. Yes, Thursday is not an ideal time for everybody, so I'm going to send out another online vote, a doodle poll, whether we should move it to Wednesday morning or keep it on Thursday afternoon. I think that was fairly even between Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock. But you'll be voting online on that. And regarding the format of the course, in the first few weeks, I think I'll introduce some theoretical concepts or other things about Julia and packages, environment, software engineering, and so on. And afterwards, it should be a bit more project-based. That is, you can't learn a language until you actually do something. So that is, I hope you do exercises, homework or something, well, unofficial homework. And then in the end, you should all do some kind of project with Julia if you really want to learn it. And then we can discuss topics as they come up working on your particular projects. So if you think of this course as a real course that you would take for credit, which of course I think basically no one of you is doing, then it would be a reading course, but you can also make contributions. Ah, very good, very good. Yeah, talk to me about the details. We can arrange that. And what? There was something else I wanted to say. Yes, some of the things don't need to be presented by myself. Some of the things can be presented as well by people of the audience. So this is a possible syllabus. These are the interesting things about Julia that we can talk about. You see, not all of these things are about the language itself. There's, for example, basic introduction, that's today, the type system, which is what really sets the language apart. Macros, which were invented more than half a century ago, still exist in very few languages, and a few other topics, in particular down here. There were movies from a Julia conference. We can maybe watch a few sections of some interesting movies together and then discuss whatever comes up if you find something interesting. And the various external Julia packages add-ons, there must be more than 100 by now. So if you find an interesting package, one of you could give a short introduction of the package to the community here. I'm thinking 10, 20 minutes or something, like a paper presentation in a journal club. So let's make this a bit interactive. I want to know what actually interests you so that I can talk about that. Otherwise, it's just me talking to you. No one is interested. So I want to take a quick vote about who of you is interested in what part of these features here. And so this is a wiki. I just click edit. And then we scroll down here and see the source code. So introduction, not Julia's type system, connection to C++, and so on. Who is interested in that? Okay. All? It's not everybody who would care. Macros, connection to Lisp, with computer science, I think. Let's make this three or four people or something. Concurrent distributed programming. Mm. Yeah, that's again everybody. Linear algebra. Mm. Yeah, same thing. Graphing, plotting, things like that. Make that three quarters. I wonder what the other quarters are. What is the coolest thing every time? How you can actually, get some nice graphics out for your papers or movies for your talks. Then software engineering modules, packages, how civil people can contribute, GitHub, and so on. Who's interested in that? Let's make that eight or so. I'm very interested in that, so I'm going to present that nevertheless. You have to sit through that. Okay, this is about performance, and then in Julia, this is about type stability, profiling, disassembling, low-level programming. 1, 2, 3, 1/2 or something. And then persistence, this is about I/O, how you can save your data and read them in 5 years later and with the different Julia package and so on. Who's interested in that? 1, 2, 1. Okay, one person. Let's make it 2, it doesn't look so bad. Interfacing with other languages, with Python, C, Fortran, a few other codes there. That is, again, basically everybody solving in PDE in Julia. That's what I do in my own research. 1, 2, 3. Okay, yeah, that's about half of you. Very good. Introduce various external packages, batch videos, and so on. They don't need to take a vote of that. Okay, very good. That's helpful. Look at that. Yes. Okay, now someone else, please. Make it a bit smaller. Okay, let me first begin with an introduction about why I find Julia interesting, why I think it's an interesting language, because there's about a new language every year, an important new language developed. So why is Julia interesting? If you have a small project that you do between lunch and the coffee break, then it doesn't matter what language you use, right? You do it at the back of the envelope, Mathematica, MATLAB, it works just fine. Have a larger project that involves 3-4 people or a collaboration or something, or you want to base your PhD thesis on it, then you need to think about ahead. And I think, at least from my research, there are 3 properties that are important for a language. First, the usual thing, there's kind of a few percent of the code, 1% or 10%, that takes up 90% or 99% of the total runtime. And computers are always too slow. So the idea is you want to optimize that and want to really dive into the bits, and the language needs to support it. I mean, you need to do that somehow. And you can multiply 2 matrices in 10 lines of code, but if you look at actual matrix multiplication codes, there are more 1,000 lines of code. And why? Because it's 100 times faster than if you write it in 10 times. But of course, it's difficult to do that. So, and I have put Python there in red. Oh, it looks a bit dark here, but it's still very clearly red because this is what Python does not do, right? Red is bad here, not important. And then if you have an actual software project, then most of the code is not about the core thing, but it's just managing complexity. You're reading parameter files, you have various algorithms that you're trying, and this and that, and it's just complex things, business logic or something. There's a postdoc here, Miles Stoudemire. Miles, is he here? Hey, there, I saw you, yes. So this is what iTensor does, right? It doesn't do the matrix multiplications, there's a library for that, and it doesn't do the nice user interface. I mean, it doesn't specify any tensor networks. The whole library is just about managing complexity and doing things efficiently. And since it's about managing complexity, the most important there is to keep the code correct. It doesn't have to be efficient, that's in the small kernels, and it doesn't have to be easy to use. You rather want it correct. If your routine expects an integer, you pass a string. The question is, how quickly does the code detect that? And is the code able to actually give you a line number of the function where things go wrong? And this is where Mathematica really stinks. It's a really nice language, but trying to get a line number for an error message or something out is basically impossible, also this type of information. And if you accidentally try to add an integer and a string in Mathematica, then Mathematica will just say, oh yeah, I don't know how to do that. The result is an expression consisting of an integer plus a string, no error message, nothing. And that is really not helpful for large-scale programming, right? In your lunch break, typing in something, solving something, Mathematica is ideal. And finally, number 3 is all the development and the testing and playing around with new ideas that you need to do. And this is, of course, where Python shines, or Mathematica, or MATLAB. But in C or C++, this is really bad. So if you want to multiply 2 matrices, you can do that, as I mentioned, in C++ in 10 lines of code. But try defining 2 matrices and calling that routine and printing the output, you probably need 50 lines of code for that. So you write 50 lines of code to kind of play with an algorithm that takes 10 lines of code. It doesn't make sense. And Python, if you want to multiply a few matrices, you can probably do it in 3 or 4 lines of code. It's much simpler. So these are the features that you need from a language. And Julia caught my attention because it's the first language that actually addresses all 3 of these. So my hope is that by doing Julia, I can kind of drop C++ and Python and the other things. Now that's usually projects use multiple languages because you can't do everything. For example, you can do the bottom 2 in Python, and the first one you use in C, call a C routine or something with interfaces. Okay, but that's not the only thing. In project management, you need also a few other things, and I'm talking about the bad things of Python. You need to make sure things run everywhere, portable. If it runs only on Linux, it doesn't work because I'm using a Mac and other people use Windows or something. You need to find the people who use that, so language needs to be widely known. I don't know whether Julia is widely known. I mean, the people interested in Julia, that's okay. But if you want to hire a new student, and you can't probably expect them to know Julia, whereas Python, you may want to expect that. Another thing is the language needs to have a future. And with Julia, you don't know that. It's an immature language. It's right now in version 0.4, but there's an active user community and is diverse. There's people from all different fields, financial computing and PDEs and math and graphs and computer science and so on. So I think there's hope. So I'm betting on Julia, but can't promise that it actually works out. So now let me, I'm jumping a bit forth and back what I was going to show next. I was going to next look at the Julia homepage, and basically go through the list of features that are advertised there for the language and spend a few minutes on each of the features, most of the features, of actually describing what is meant. And this may be a bit boring if you don't know computing, but if you know another language, for example, C++ or Python or something, this is kind of a nice comparison point. And well, maybe I should try to get it done in 5 minutes rather quickly, because then you can place Julia in the space of languages. If you already know these things, then we can skip that. Okay, let's do that. Okay, multiple dispatch. That maybe I should give an example for that. So let's switch to, so this is a Julia interpreter here, and later on I'm going to show you how to access that. So this is Julia. If you type 2 + 3, you can all read that, right? Yep, and the result is 5. And say if you want to multiply two matrices, then if you implement that in Python, you would write something like a.mul(b) or something. There are two objects, and there's a multiplication function, and you tell the matrix A that it should multiply itself with B. And this is convenient if you have different types of matrices, real, complex, sparse matrix, symmetric matrices, and so on. You may want to use different routines, multiplication routines in both cases. That's just an example here. And the problem with Python is that it dispatches only on the first argument A, right? That is the object. So it looks at A, what kind of matrix it is, sparse or symmetric or not, and depending on that, it uses the multiplication routine. But it doesn't look at B, so if you want to have different cases for real times complex, complex times real, then A needs to know about all the different matrix types that exist. And Julia has multiple dispatch, and Julia writes something like mul A, B. Well, I can't press enter because I haven't defined the variables, obviously. And it has dispatch on all the variables, all the types in that expression. And that leads to more flexibility. And it is something like that would be called overloading in C++. But the difference is this is dynamic. So in C++, this would be a combination of virtual function calls and overloading. And in this way, it exists neither in C++ nor in Python. It does exist in Lisp and other languages, and people are proud of it. So, I mean, unless you're into the handling complexity and software engineering part, you may not really care about that. I mean, the result of that is the language is a bit more flexible, a bit more easier to use, and routines run faster. But apart from that, it's a bit of a theoretical example. Hey, why don't we just multiply two matrices, right? Let's define a matrix A, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then a matrix B, 5, 6, 7, 8. So this is kind of a 2D notation, and here this notation is similar to MATLAB. I don't know MATLAB well enough, but that may be. And then if you multiply them, oh, it's probably not MAL, it's probably a star, right? That's probably that one. Let's try. Looks right, right? Yeah, okay. And of course, in this case, it was two dense matrices with integer coefficients, so that choosing multiplication routine is quite trivial in that case. The prefix notation? Oh yeah, now it's a bit a complicated detail, but you can also write things like that. So the multiplication operator is actually a function with a rather weird name. I mean, the name is just the star symbol. And if you call it like that, then you get the same thing. Yeah, and then the second hesitation when I type enter here, I think that's just the communication. I'm actually running on the SEE via web interface. I mean, it's not Julia that is so slow. I mean, multiplying these matrices takes less than a millisecond, right? A microsecond or something. Good, let's go back to, yes, it's this one here, the dynamic type system. This is the big difference between Julia and Python. In Python, if you write a routine, you just say what the variable names are that are accepted. In Julia, you can add comments, or can add the types. And that, of course, A, it serves as the documentation. If you say, well, that should be a string, that should be an integer, it can be used for optimization because the compiler knows what to expect. And of course, it's also used for dispatch. I don't know whether we should do an example here. Can certainly do that, right? You define a function, f x, y equals, what should we calculate? X times y plus z or something. that is a function definition. And then we call it like that. And you can also give argument types. So use double colon. And this. Result, of course, is the same that you're getting. Yeah, I'm skipping about some of the details here. Good performance, approaching that of languages like C. That is one of the important things, that if the compiler has all this type information and so on, then it can generate code that rivals C or C++. So this is version 0.4 of the language. There are some corner cases where things don't work out as expected, but I mean that they'll fix that over the course of the next half year or year or something. Down here, there are actually some benchmarks, and I'm not too fond of these kind of benchmarks because it sounds like a contest. My language is bigger than yours, and comparing all these different languages, different compilers or something here. But if you just look at the numbers, then you saw Julia is doing pretty well here. For example, Fibonacci numbers, just because a function calls adding numbers, Julia is 50 times faster than Python. There's R and MATLAB. I think this is, 2014. I think that's 2015 out there updating the benchmarks, because 2015 has the optimizations built in, and some of these large numbers here should now be 100 times faster or something. But if you compare Julia to other languages, where is C in here? Oh, C is one, thank you. Yes, okay. Well, Fortran language, yeah. So you see, this is basically the same, basically one. And if you look at how the code looks like, then you see the code does not look crazy. There are certain versions of Python, Cython or something, where you need to add annotations to make it faster. This is, for example, the Mandelbrot routine. You know the Mandelbrot set when you display it. And this is an efficient way of writing it in Julia. And as you know, you don't need any kind of type annotations because the compiler can figure it all out. So for example, Z is the argument. It's a complex number. Then the compiler finds out, of course, if Z is complex, C is going to be complex. Mark Zeta is, of course, an integer. N is a for argument, so it's also an integer. And then it knows all the types of the variables, and this is just a complex power function and so on, and that function. And this is an example how Python looks like. How Julia looks like. In Python, you remember you need to do all the indentation. And in C++, you have all the curly braces. And here, instead, you have all these end statements, like you'd have in modular, this function ends here at this end, this for ends at this end, this if ends at this end, and compared to C and so on, you'd note that you don't have to put any parentheses about the for arguments or the if statements and so on. But it's just about the syntax of the language. Okay, let's move on a bit. There's a built-in package manager. This is about software engineering where you can get external packages. Lisp like macros and other metaprogramming facilities. So under the hood, Julia is actually a very Lisp-like language. It's essentially just the rebranded Lisp. And I think I need to say something about that, because Lisp is a very divisive language, because some people absolutely love Lisp and other people absolutely hate it. And I kind of expected some of you to walk out of the room now that I mentioned Lisp. No, it's really that bad in computer science. And it's all a question about syntax. So how do you, when you call to calculate the sine of x, how do you write it? And there's obviously the right way of writing it, where you write sine of x with a parenthesis around the x. Most computer languages do that. Fix it online here. And then, of course, what Lisp does, it puts the parenthesis around the sine, not around the x. And that's, of course, completely the wrong thing to do. And many people are so offended by that that they don't want to look at the language. And it seems really silly, but I don't know why that is. It just rubs people the wrong way. And in Mathematica, of course, it's completely different. Sine is with an uppercase S, and use square brackets instead of round parentheses. And it also rubs some people the wrong way. I know senior faculty who don't use Mathematica. They use rather MATLAB, and they quote that as a reason. I don't know whether they're joking or I don't know. This kind of syntax is surprisingly important to people. It's amazing. But of course, my argument is the right way is, of course, to write it like that without parentheses. Because who of you would write sine of X on a blackboard? But you would all write it like that, so in principle, all the computer languages are wrong, except the ones that look like that, of course. Anyway, Julia is in the first category, top there. You write sine of x, and it looks in MATLAB or in Python. Anyway, Lisp-like macros. Oh, yes, macros. You may know macros from C or C++. These macros have the same name, but they have basically nothing in common. This is much more convenient. You can call Python and C packages if you have them. That's quite efficient, no details here, blah, blah. designed for parallelism and distributed computing. You may know that if you want to get the full performance out of a computer, you need to do parallel or distributed computing. Distributed computing is rather easy with Julia. We are going to have a talk about that. Parallel computing is a bit of a lie because it doesn't actually work yet. So there's a branch where some people are developing something, and maybe in half a year or a year, it will work. But at the moment, you can't use multi-threading in Julia. There's something that they call lightweight green threading, which is something like coroutines, but that is not actually multi-threading. I have again a PowerPoint slide on that, and I noticed that this is a bit theoretical, but I want to make these points. Anyway, parallel computing. I like parallel computing and distributed computing, and this is part of my research, so I'm going to give you the basics of that. And there are three concepts: concurrent, parallel, and distributed computing, each more complex and more powerful than the previous. Concurrency means something like multitasking, like one person doing multiple things, and you just switch between tasks, and you can switch very quickly. And that basically just simplifies programming, but it doesn't improve performance in any way. In Python, this would be called a generator, or in Modulo, it would be called a coroutine. And this is the one that Julia supports. But it's still only one task active at the time. It's just the switching between tasks is very efficient. And if you have parallel computing, you have multiple threads that are active at at the same time. And then you get in all these troubles between synchronizing, making sure that the two threads don't do things at the same time that conflict. And this, people do it to improve performance on multiple cores. For example, this laptop has 4 cores, this phone, I don't know. What do you think? Probably 2 cores or something, and the big workstations that we have 16 cores or something. And of course, if you want to get that performance, then you need to do the parallel computing. And that's the one that does not quite work yet in Julia. And distributed computing gives you even more performance because you can connect the different computers, and large supercomputers have 10,000 nodes or something. So if you do distributed computing right, you can, in principle, if your algorithms allow that, increase your performance by a factor of 10,000. That, of course, means you can do completely new things that are otherwise impossible to do on the laptop. And this is kind of supported by Julia, and you can also use it to fake parallel computing. You can just treat this laptop as 4 different laptops, and with distributed computing, you can do that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. With the second point, would this be OpenMP in the end? So do you expect this in a year or so to be implemented in Julia to be OpenMP?
That's still open for debate. So what they currently have is kind of low-level primitives, such as creating threads and having new mutexes on something. And that's not what you want to use for programming. And some people think about an OpenMP-like facility where you have a loop, and then you have some prefix before the loop and say, okay, do that on multiple cores. But in the end, this only works if you have arrays. And if you have some kind of uneven load, yet you have some calculations that take much longer than others, then the OpenMP style may not work. So I'm hoping for something else. I'm hoping that they take the tasks they currently have, these ones here, and turn them into something parallel. But there are arguments against that as well, because tasks are much easier to use than parallel computing, because in tasks, you never need to synchronize locks or anything. And with parallel computing, you do. But the style that they currently have for distributed computing, that looks a bit like OpenMP. Like, create a task, wait for all the tasks you have created. There's a distributed array running over all the processes and so on.
So you're really saying that this distributed computing would be simpler than MPI, for instance?
Yes.
That's, of course, very, very nice, no?
Yes. I'm not saying it's faster than MPI.
Okay.
But, you may know Unified Parallel C or High Performance Fortran or things like that. And some of the things that are implemented in Julia are like that. I'd say all these things in Julia are currently experimental and work very well in kind of 90% of the cases. If you hit a corner case, there's still things going on and things that are redesigned. And even the standard library is being redesigned, right? Version 0.4 of the language. So this may become much easier or much better or much faster in the future. Yep, going back here. User-defined types, this is, I said it before, but this is now I actually mean it, this is the main difference between Julia and Python. In Julia, in Python, you have Cython and AdJit attributes, attractors, whatever, that there are ways to compile Python to C and make it go faster. But there's one thing you cannot do in these, and this is define fast types. So in Julia, if the complex number type is defined in terms of real numbers, and it has the same speed as in C or in Fortran, right? One complex number consists of two real numbers. If you did that in Python, then each complex number would be an object, and the real and imaginary part would be part of a dictionary. Each time you access them, you have to look, do some string lookup in a dictionary. Each time you create a complex number, you have to do memory allocation. That's probably a factor 100 slower, and in Julia it isn't. And part of that is that you can define types, and once you define a type, the type is fixed. It cannot change, like in C++. Where in Julia, if you define an object, you can always modify the object later. Very flexible, but you don't get the performance. And this is what you get in Julia, the performance. And automatic different specialized code for different argument types, that's of course C++ templates under a different name here. And the remainder is just not so interesting anymore. So yeah, Unicode, but all the languages have that these days. There were the benchmarks. Is there something else I wanted to do here? I think there was not. Getting started. Okay, if you go to the Julia webpage, there's of course information about documentation, tutorials, and so on. Feel free to look there and look at that. And if your documentation, you see the bottom right corner, that says currently release 0.4. There's also documentation of release 0.3 and 0.5. You should look at the right version, otherwise certain things may not work the right way you expected. You're going to use version 0.4 that is going to be released real soon now. I mean, they have a release candidate out, and I think it will be released within the next month or so. So that's the version we are using. And manual is kind of an introduction to Julia that you can read. The standard library is more of a reference manual, and the developer documentation are for people who want to develop Julia itself. And is there something here that is interesting? No, there is not. Okay, so the remainder of my presentation, I was going to just give you a quick rundown of the syntax of Julia so you can play for it yourself. Before I do that, I should probably teach you how to use Julia. So there are several ways. First, on the Julia webpage, there are packages for Julia. You can just install them, and that should work out of the box. Pick one of the 0.4 release candidate packages there, because that's what you're going to use, and that should work nicely under OS X and on the Linux, and probably also under Windows. If you don't want to do that, then you can log in to our computing cluster here. If you log in your web browser to compute.pi.local or compute12345.pi.local, then you need to type on your username and password, and then this picture should appear, and that is called Jupyter. And if you then go into new, you can start new Julia notebook. You can also have MATLAB Python notebooks and so on. Why is that there? And this is how that looks. And after a few seconds, the kernel has started, and then you can type things in here. And if you do that now, then you can follow with what I'm typing. So I think I should wait now for 5 minutes for all of you who are interested to log in. But of course, maybe all of you already logged in there. So yeah, you can sit next to someone else who has a notebook and can look in. Sorry.
It won't work with Safari.
Yes, thank you. Very good. Yes, that's why I'm using Chrome.
Sorry, you said many things. Which one?
It's your choice. I would recommend this one, the Jupyter thingy, where you don't need to install anything because you can just log in. You should be done in a minute or so. Yes, so the URL is compute,
right,
and then a number, 123.pi.local, and then you should see a window asking you for your username and password, and that's your regular parameter username and password.
So when you say 123, you mean the one.
Yeah, I type here compute.pi.local, and you can insert something else. If you all use compute.pi.local, then things will run a bit slowly. But you can just type compute.pi.local. And all the other things, the crossed out HTTPS and the Ishnetter notebooks and so on, that will be added automatically. He's using Windows.
You may need the HTTPS, but it will give you a scary line message if you can
ignore. Okay. So I'm looking for a bit of feedback at the moment. Are you able to connect there?
You do need the HTTPS.
You do? Okay. So on my computer with Chrome, I didn't. Sorry for not realizing that. Yep. No, no, just type compute.padded.local. Ah, what you see then looks like that. And then you go to new and Julia. And then you probably need to wait for 30 seconds or something. And then you should see something like that. And then you calculate 1 plus 1. And if you see 2, then everything's working.
Will I be able to access the
platform? Yes, you need to use VPN, then you can access it. Yes, VPN. Mm-hmm. And all the files you create and save, so there's a save button, the floppy disk. Jesus, they should really change that. They will be in your home directory on the SCE. So these are just regular files there. What would be? Oh, I could. I never thought about that. Yes, I should do that. I should create a Julia thing. Yes, I will totally do that. Thank you. Okay, now you should be able to type 2 plus 3 and get 5 as a result. Someone still having trouble with that? 1, 2, 3. No one? Let's continue. So you know how to add numbers. There's, of course, always the question in the language, what happens if you divide 1 over 2? What is the result? C says the result is 0. Of course, it's not 0. In Julia, the result is 0.5. So if you divide 2 integers, you get a floating point number. That may be interesting. There's also the other operator that is kind of interesting. That is the backslash iterator. That is just the inverse fraction. So this is 2 over 3. Exponentiation is with that sign, not with double stars, small syntax. And of course, each of the objects that you have here, integers and so on, has a particular type. There's a type of function. So type of 8 is integer. On my system, that's a 64-bit integer. And type of 8.0 is float 64, and you have complex numbers and so on. And of course, you have also strings. So if you write A, B, C, then this is an ASCII string because it has only ASCII characters. If I type off something with an accent, how do I get an accent? Yep. Then this turns into a UTF-8 string, which can handle all sorts of Chinese characters as well. Do we need to talk? Yeah. Tuples, maybe. You can create tuples if you put values in parentheses with commas. For example, 2, 4.1, and then square root of, doesn't matter. So that's the tuple out of 3 numbers. There's 2, 4.0, and 5 plus 4. M is the imaginary unit, and we can calculate the type of that. And it's a tuple that has an integer, a floating point number, and a complex integer number. You can have strings. You only saw that before. ABC, boring. If you define a variable, x equals 1, then you can use string interpolation, x equals $x. Dollar evaluates the next expression. So this is x equals 1. You can also have something complicated there. For example, x equals $. Now you need to put parentheses here, x plus 1. That gives x equals 2. And it can also make it a bit more complicated. String, hello, and then an expression. String equals length. Now this is a bit hairy. Let's see whether I get it correct. So in that dollars parentheses, I have another open quote, put another string, and that works nicely. String equals length. I should have called it length. So in this dollar interpolation, you can have arbitrary Julia expressions. There's no restriction on that. You can even have quotes and put another string there if you want. Of course, that's too complicated for anybody to understand. You should use a temporary variable if you ever wanted to do that. And that's how you put quotes in a string with a backslash, of course. println outputs it. Man, I hate this user interface that always ends these messages. This is hello world. And Yeah, there's also an info command that outputs something to standard error with just an info. There's a warn command that outputs something. And of course, this is an error. Which actually throws an expression. Throws an exception. So this actually is an error. Okay. Things, interpolation, math, comparisons. Of course, you can write things like something 1 less than 2. That is true. 1 less than 2 is larger than 3. That is false. 1 less than 3 less than equal 2 is true. So you can daisy chain comparison operators that way, which is different the way than C or Fortran is working. How does Python do that? Oh, man. Okay. Sorry. Comparisons. Where are the bindings? Okay. If you have a variable, say x equals 4, and then assign the variable a new value, x equals 5, every time you assign something, the variable completely changes the value. That is important. If a variable holds an array, for example, I say a equals 1, 2, 3, that's an array with 3 elements. And then if I say a plus equals 1, that should increase, add 1 to every array element. I'm getting myself confused now. Sorry, b equals a. It may be too complicated anyway, what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to say is if you say a, b plus equals 1, then this changes the binding of b. B then points to a new array. So plus equals 1 creates a new array and changes that and assigns it to p on the original array that before was available to A, still has the original value. That is because arrays are objects, they exist independent of the variables, and if you change the binding of the variable, you don't necessarily change the array. It's a bit of a complex thing. Maybe I'm going through that too fast here.
Equals doesn't copy data into other data, right? It doesn't overwrite data, it just rebinds like new variable.
Yes, so B plus equals 1 is the same as B equals B plus 1. B plus 1 is a evaluated expression that creates a new array. That is then assigned to B.
You should probably show them what happens when you get like A1 plus A.
Ah, yes. Okay, very good. So we look at B and then B1 plus equals 1. And then B is 3, 3, 4. So if you do something on array elements, then of course B doesn't change.
You had A and B being assigned the same reference?
Yeah, okay, good, very good. B equals A. No, they are the same. And then B1 plus equals 1. And then B is 2 to 3. And A is also 2 to 3. Because I didn't change the variable A, this changed the array element A. And you can get your brain kind of in a bind if you don't. I gave a Python course here last year, and it was the same problem. I didn't know the details, but Jonah beautifully explained what happens with various subscripting and so on. You can also write it like this, and this actually changes all the array elements of B, not B itself. And then you see that A also changed. Okay, this was not a good explanation. Somehow my brain feels a bit mushy. I have a cold, sorry. I'll blame it on that. We'll probably come to that later on.
But you're saying that we are not making a copy. You say B equals A, you're not making a copy of A.
Yes, if you're saying B equals A, then both point to the same. Maybe I should use the blackboard at the moment and do something here. So there's an array. It holds the values 1, 2, 3. And then A points to that. And if you say B equals A, then B points the same thing. If you change an array element, you change the values of both A and B. But if you say array plus 1, that's an expression. Then you get a new array with the values 2, 3, 4. And if you assign this array then to B, then you have this constellation, and then A and B are actually different arrays because you assign something to B. And that's something that the syntax is different than in Python. You get both effects as well in Python, and that is confusing. And every few months there are questions on the user's mailing list because it's difficult to capture. Because in mathematics, of course, it doesn't appear. Because in mathematics, I mean, truths are true eternally. Whereas here, B has one value and then it points to a different object. There's a before and after the assignment, and that kind of creates a bit of a confusion. I should have prepared something more structured for that. Sorry. You have for loops. For example, for I in 1 to 10. What? Sorry. then we output I, and that, of course, does what you think. It outputs the numbers from 1 to 10. And there's a typical syntax of the for loop. There's the no parentheses or anything necessary. It could also do that on the same line. And as you see, you don't need semicolons in between. Sometimes you may want to add them for clarity, but you don't need to. There are also if statements. If 1 less than 2, println less, else not less, Jesus. And end of the if statement, which is this, but of course usually you would format that more nicely like this. Indentation does not matter in Julia, you know it matters in Python.
So you want these steps in the for loop.
Yes, so 1 colon 10 is actually a range element. 1 colon 10 exists on its own. And you can look at the type of 110. That is a unit range. That means a step in unit ranges of integers. And you can also 110 in 2. That's a stepped range, where both are integer. And if you go up to the for loop, we can, where's the for loop here? 110, 2, and then
it's 1, 2, 10.
Ha, 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 thank you. Yeah, next lecture, you're giving that. Then it counts like that. And of course, there are also while loops, whatever, x equals 1, while x less than 10, x plus equals 1, info x, and it does whatever you expect it to do. We already had tuples. Vectors, so 1, 2, 3, this is a vector. 1, 2, 3, 4 with spaces and semicolon. This gives you a two-dimensional array, which is also called a matrix. And you can also do higher dimensional arrays. This syntax may change in the future. It's convenient. I think it comes from MATLAB, this difference here.
No.
Tuples are immutable. That is, if you want to change a tuple, you have to do it that way, create a new tuple, and then assign it to the same variable. That is, the variable that holds a tuple is, of course, mutable. But you can't change a tuple. Tuples are not objects.
And they can have
mutable. Yes, yes.
Arrays can.
Arrays cannot, no. Well, arrays can, actually. So you can have an array of 1A, 1.0 or something. And this has the type array anyone. That is, any is kind of a super type of every possible type in Julia. And now you have an array where you can put any type in there. And if you write something like 1, 2, 3, then you get an array of integer. And this, you can only put integers in there. And this is also a major difference between Julia and Python, because regular Python arrays are lists of that type. And if you iterate over that array, every time you look at an element, you have to check what the type is and access it, and that is slow. And these are kind of the NumPy arrays in Python, well, probably with float, not with int. And this is very efficient because you know exactly the type. And this array here probably costs, whatever, 24 bytes in memory, because you only need to store the length and the individual elements. And here, all these elements may need a different amount of memory, so the array actually only holds pointers and type information and so on. It's much more complex. I want to show you list comprehensions. For example, you write x plus 1 for x in 1 to 5. Let's hope that the syntax is right. Yep. That's kind of a way to easily generate an array by applying arbitrary functions here. And you can x plus y for x in 1,5, y in 1 to 2. Does that also work? Yep. Now you have two for loops, x and y in there, so the result is a 2D array. And that corresponds to the, say, the table statement in Mathematica, what you get here. And I think you can also have an if statement in there. I'm not sure. There's something strange about these arrays. So if you have 1, 2, and then a subarray, 3, 4 in Julia, then this does not give you an array with a subarray, but rather these are automatically flattened. It gives you a single array with four elements. People don't like it anywhere, so you get tons of warnings about that, that the meaning of that statement is probably going to change in Julia 0.5 a year from now. Okay? Yeah, there's a cool thing. There's a constant called nothing. And this is just lumpy, the empty structure. It's like void in Z. It's a data type that takes 0 bits of storage. It's convenient to have. Nothing has a type, which is void, corresponding to the similar to void in C. And let's also briefly talk about parametric types, which corresponds to templates in C++. In C++, templates are a bit cumbersome because they were kind of introduced later in the language. In Julia, they were put in the beginning, so they're much easier to use. So if you write a function, let's call it G because I defined F, A, B equals A plus B, then A and B can have any type. And of course, if at runtime you try to add these two types and there's no corresponding addition function, there's going to be an error. If you say A int, B int, let's call it H, then this can only handle integers. And you can write something like, what to call it now, the function, right? Q. This now means that T is a type parameter. A and B can have any type. It must be the same type, and then you can add them. So this function can now be called with integers, with floats, and so on, but there's this additional constraint that A and B must have the same type. And this is similar to templates.
Well, we didn't have to give those different names in general, right?
Pardon?
We didn't have to give those different names.
The functions?
Yeah.
No, of course, you can use overloading, you can use the same function, but then if I want to talk about the function FGA, then it's easier if they have different names.
Yeah.
But they kind of the same name, yes.
What's the definition of line 71 faster than 69?
No. They have all the same speed if they are defined. So for example, if you want to add string plus integer, it probably doesn't work. And then, of course, string plus integer, you couldn't call that. That's a type error. But here, of course, you could call it. That's just a runtime error because there's no function plus found. And oh, yeah, something really strange. Oh, man, that annoys me about the language here. How do you concatenate two strings? You multiply them. The idea is that there's an empty string and that each string is kind of a group operator and then the operators concatenate. And I don't know. I hope they're going to change that because this is, I don't know. That's just different for the fun of it. There's no reason to use, anyway. But you can't add them. That doesn't work. Syntax error. But of course, you can say, A to the fifth power, which of course, according to the same rules, give you that, yeah. I mean, in other languages, you would say A times 5 to get 5 A's. Okay, anyway, just think about strings. Okay, this is that. You can define new types. You do that via the type keyword, for example, type, how would you call it, type point. Types usually use uppercase names, of course, you don't have to. And then X, int, Y, int, and. And then we have a new type defined, type point, and you use it in the usual way. For example, P equals point 2.3. Then you have a point with these values, and P dot X plus P dot Y, this is the same syntax. And then P dot X equals 12, and then look at P, then the point change. So these types are mutable objects, the same way these arrays are. You can also define immutable types. That is mostly useful if the types are rather small, and that can lead to performance increases. And then you would write immutable I point, I don't know. And then IP I point 2.3. And if I try to assign something, that's not possible because you can't change it. Of course, you can say IP equals I point 12, IP dot Y, kind of you make a copy, but for one of these elements, instead of making a copy, you create something, you get something new, and then IP has the new value here. That is the same case as here. We're probably going to talk about that in more detail at a later lecture. Okay, there's a help system built in if you type the question mark and want to know something, for example, about the operator plus. No, that's a bad example. What could we want to help on? Pardon?
Light bulb.
Okay, that's not very good. The documentation is very good, but apparently for this type of function, it's just three lines. So with a question mark, in this web interface, you don't see anything. If you use a command line interface and type the question mark, then the cursor color changes and so on, and you can do searching. You can also use semicolon and then type a Unix expression, a Unix command, for example, pwd, and then you know my home directory, or ls minus l, and then it lists the content of the home directory. It's convenient if you want to type something quickly. Yep.
Are we able to search the help class from
Let me check that. So if you So if you press tab, you get this one. Everything that begins with tie. That's not really a good search function. There may be a search function, but what I recommend is going to. Okay, my window vanished. Okay. Anyway, there is a. There's of course Julia documentation on the web. You can go there. It has a search bar and Google and so on that is there. And of course there are mailing lists. You can subscribe. You can ask questions and so on if you want.
Is that purpose to be counter? In the command line, you have in and then the counter.
So I think you can type in 89 and then. To get the previous command. And you can also type out 89, which should be empty or something. So this is the same thing that you get in MATLAB or in Mathematica, that all, everything you entered before is kind of served.
You can use that as
yes. Variables. I mean, this is if you use that interface here, right? If you write a large Julia program, you would not use that interface. You would rather type something into an editor, and you would use that. And there's also something with backwards. Should I show that? Sure, why not? So. This is a Unix command. You put it in backquotes, then it turns into a command. We can look at the type of it. It's a command. And you can run it and do something. This is how you run external codes and see it would be system or exec or something. And it has to have some few nice features about how to do that in Julia. Okay. So this is a quick rundown of the language Julia and the syntax that exists there. If you already know syntax, the syntax of Julia, then this may have been a bit boring. I was trying to lighten it up with a bit of theoretical explanations. And apart from that, what you should do is make sure you have access to that, to have Julia installed. And then I would. Okay, I don't find the wiki anymore. Okay, anyway, you remember the wiki page, the syllabus. Next time we can talk about a few other things. And I think next time we're going to talk about two topics, something like, for example, the type system, that it was the first big one, and something else. At the same time, I'm looking for volunteers, because we're all doing this together, to introduce some of the other topics, for example, plotting, linear algebra, and other things. If you want to present something on that, if you know, think you know Julia well enough, you're welcome to send me an email and suggest that you want to do that. If you want to take this class for credit, then I recommend to do this once or twice during the semester. OK, do you have questions? I think it got a bit boring in the end. I'll try to liven it up a bit more for the next course next week. Otherwise, since I'm not feeling well, I'd like to conclude today after only 1 hour. Usually, I think we should meet for 2 hours that we can do can get something really done in one session a week. Next week in the Alice room. Thank you.